This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys.
Welcome, ladies and germs, back to the Hard Traveling Studios with a fresh post-Thanksgiving episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me is Nick Duke. We are live via tape delay in the beautiful, luxurious Vancouver, British Columbian studios of the Hard Traveling Fanboys in Ho-Ho Loon Plaza. And Nick, how was your Thanksgiving break?
It was good. It was a good break. Always nice to take some time and spend with family and whatnot and all that good stuff. So it was fine.
Lots of eating.
Oh, lots of eating, of course. Of course.
Indeed. So.
How about you?
Oh, it was fine. It was solid. I didn't eat as much as I wanted to. I didn't get to go home with any leftovers, which was unfortunate. But nonetheless, it was a good time had by most. And a relatively enjoyable Thanksgiving given circumstances. So solid enough time. And now it's back to the real world, Nick. It's back to the grindstone. It's back to the longest running weekly episodic
comic book podcast
in all Place to Be Nation. And hang on, I'm getting an alert over here, Nick. It says touchdown. Down Bills?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Weird. I don't understand that. In any event, it is good to be back in the studios, sort of. So, Nick, we are ready to...
God, sort of.
We are ready not to kick off a theme month as we originally had planned, but rather to go into what we're going to call Wing It Month.
Yep.
Where we're just going to wing it. We're going to throw
Figure
stuff
it out.
At the wall. See what happens. See what develops, right? And to start things off, we're going to go back. We're going to give you, first of all, this is an episode of Off the Page, wherein we look at a piece of comic book media that is outside the actual comic books themselves. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to go back to the well with what I think both of us consider to be one of our finest creative outputs in our extended careers. And that was our column that we wrote for placetobenation.com several years ago. I believe it would have been 2014, perhaps, when
God.
We wrote this column. And it was a review of the two-part premiere of the 1999 Spider-Man animated series, Spider-Man Unlimited.
Yeah, so super relevant, even in 2014.
Yes, so you would, if you had a chance to just search through the Hard Traveling Fanboys archives and go back to the very beginning, you'll find this is one of our earliest columns when we were still flexing our writing muscles. And I thought it was pretty fun. It was a good time, fairly well written. And most importantly, it was a blast to watch this just god-awfully terrible show. And still, one of the lesser products that we have experienced here on the show. Not the worst, certainly not Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles: The Next Mutation, but certainly a bad product that
it'd be pretty near the bottom, honestly. Like it not the worst, but. I mean, God, I can't even remember some of the really bad things we've watched for Off the Page, but it's down there for sure.
Yeah, it not great, but nonetheless, we are here to return to Spider-Man Unlimited. All these years later, we thought with 200 approaching, HTF 200 that is approaching, what better time to go back and revisit some of our favorite topics from the past? And certainly Spider-Man Unlimited was one of those. And so since we reviewed the first two episodes way back when, we wanted to go back and review the last two episodes of Spider-Man Unlimited. How did this curious project come to an end? It was a 13-episode initial season, and it was never picked up for a second season. So this is it, 13 episodes of Spider-Man Unlimited. How did they manage to bring the whole project home? Well, we sought it out on the Disney Plus app. That's right. This entire series is available on Disney Plus.
Indeed, it is.
And we logged on and gave it the old watch. And I think before we get into the episode reviews here, we should kind of give people a refresher on what Spider-Man Unlimited was.
Yes. Yes, we should.
Well, you see, people may be familiar with the 1994 Spider-Man animated series. It was a huge hit, ran for over 4 years, I think, or right at 4 years.
It's very fondly remembered by people, particularly of our generation. Like it is, it's often put up there, perhaps a bit. Perhaps we are being a little kinder in hindsight than it truly deserves.
It's below Batman and below X-Men, but certainly
right. But it's often put in that same group. Like when you talk about the best superhero shows in the 90s, those three are often mentioned with the understanding that that one's the third. But it still kind of rounds out that triumvirate, if you will.
And thus spake Zarathustra, and also thus. All good things must come to an end. And in 1998, the Spider-Man animated series did come to an end on something of a cliffhanger where Peter was still, I believe, searching for his lost love, Mary Jane, somewhere out there who had been taken due to some sort of shenanigans. I don't remember. That's unimportant. Fast forward a year and some change, and we get all the way to October of 1999, and... Avi Arad, who was involved with Marvel at that time, along with Saban Entertainment, or Saban Entertainment, I'm not sure how to pronounce it in this case.
Most notably responsible for the U.S. import of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
They're looking to create a low-budget animated series that can capitalize on the Spider-Man property. However... And I only discovered this, Nick, in research in preparing for this. Evidently, things went awry very early on in the process of making this show a reality. So, according to this, the goal of this project was to directly adapt, again, on a very low budget, the first 26 issues of The Amazing Spider-Man by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko.
Well,
However, Sony and Marvel had already entered the deal to produce the Spider-Man movie, and so, allegedly, Saban was cut from any source and could not use the traditional Spider-Man suit or adapt the early comics as planned. Also, right. The original idea of the series is that Spider-Man was to be stranded on a counter-Earth in which Ben Parker didn't die, and thus Peter Parker lacked the moral fortitude to resist becoming Venom. However, Marvel Comics didn't like the idea and stated that they would not do a story with two Peter Parkers.
Oh, I see. So our Peter Parker would have gone to another Earth.
Yes.
And that Earth's Peter Parker would have become Venom.
Yes. This is according to a Newsarama article, by the way. So I have no idea the validity of this. Nonetheless, they go back to the drawing board when they realize they can't do the Amazing Spider-Man adaptation. And they come back with... this. So what is this exactly? What is Spider-Man Unlimited? Well, it's quite simple, in fact, but also quite complex.
But also quite complex,
you see,
yes.
As we went over in our column, Spider-Man is viewed as being responsible for an accident that takes place, as his enemies Venom and Carnage inexplicably working together, hijack a space shuttle, an experimental space shuttle that is being boarded by astronaut John Jameson. And this space shuttle gets lost and never returns, stranded on another world. Not the soap opera Another World from the 90s, but an actual other world. Spider-Man is blamed by the public and blames himself, and he steals some chemicals from Reed Richards, makes himself a new spacey type suit, and hijacks aboard a shuttle to get himself onto this other world, which we learn is called Counter-Earth.
Yes. Now, Counter-Earth, you need to understand here, is not in another galaxy or even in another universe. It's not. It's so close. Counter-Earth, as it turns out, has been there all along. It's just on the other side of the sun. And from our Earth at all times. So we've never been able to see it.
I mean, it's a solid idea, Nick. It makes perfect sense. You can't very well use a telescope to see through the sun, right?
You can't. You can't do it. And so here on this Counter-Earth, a society very similar to our own has developed, what with – even another city called New York, except this is Counter New York. And the only main difference is the High Evolutionary has taken control of Counter Earth and created his bestials to usurp control of the government, and he is the man to who everyone answers. And of course he is being fought against by the human rebels led by Counter Mary Jane.
Yes. Also known as Karen on Counter Earth. Yes. But clearly,
Counter Mary
clearly
Jane.
She's Counter Mary Jane, right? Red yes. hair, green eyes, etc.
Peter wants to give her the, slip her a little web action.
Give her the impact webbing, huh? Mm-hmm. Huh? Yeah. Anyway, so the High Evolutionary runs this place, and he's got his bestials, the animal-human hybrids that he's created, and they rule the Earth, and the humans are kind of a lesser class of being on this planet. But a group of freedom fighters, which Spider-Man comes across, that is led by John Jameson alongside Karen, aka Counter Mary Jane, they are fighting against the High Evolutionary's rule, and John Jameson refuses to leave until he has overthrown the High Father, although they look very similar. The High Evolutionary and his mistreatment of this Counter Earth and its people. Now, along the way, apparently, Spider-Man meets a lot of counter versions of things that he's familiar with. There's Counter the Green Goblin. There's the Counter Vulture. There's Counter various entities throughout the Spider-Verse that you may encounter along the way. There's Counter J. Jonah Jameson. That's just some white-haired,
some fat dude in glasses.
Yeah, that runs a newspaper. Fittingly, when Spider-Man's stranded on this planet, rather than trying to go back to his home world, he decides to stay and help these people out, even though he's married to Mary Jane, and presumably she's missing her husband, who's been gone to this Counter Earth for some time now. And so while he's there, he decides, you know what? I might be here a while, so I'm going to need some money. So he becomes Counter Peter Parker, where he becomes a counter photographer for the Counter Daily Bugle. Nick, am I covering all the bases so far?
It's, from what I can tell, yes.
And while the other show had been good, this is sort of a counter the other show in that regard. So... whereas it was good, this is very bad.
Yes.
And whereas the other one was directly adapting interesting comic book stories, this is directly adapting nothing, and thus not very good. Here's the other thing about it. Spider-Man's suit on this show is actually not that bad. Kind of looks like Spider-Man 2099 a lot, except he has these weird like web wings for some reason. What are up with those, Nick?
I've always hated those. I need to get the web cape here. I assume it's like what you were saying earlier. They couldn't use the classic costume, so they had to do certain things to differentiate.
And yet they can use Venom and Carnage, who look exactly like themselves, and as we find out on this episode, are
Carnage does not look like himself. I'm sorry.
Well, they look
this Carnage design is awful.
They're horribly drawn. Both of them are. Both of them are terribly drawn. That's something that we should mention. The animation on this show is not good, but the drawing of Venom and Carnage is just it looks like a seventh grader sketched them out. You know, not good. So yes, Venom and Carnage stowed out on that ship, and they're working for something called the Synoptic, which is some sort of a hive mind symbiote or symbiote on this planet. And you've got the Knights of Wundagor, which are bestials that are even further evolved from the other bestials. You've got people like Lord Tiger and your favorite character, I know, Sir Ram.
Sir Ram, yes.
What kind of animal is Sir Ram, Nick?
Sir Ram is a ram.
Very good. And Lord Tiger?
A tiger.
Oh, very good. Very good. Well, I think we've caught you up to speed on the premise of this show. Spider-Man's trying to help these freedom fighters overthrow the high evolutionary. And what happened to the low and middle evolutionaries, we'll never know, Nick.
No. But, you know, there was a planned second season of the show that never got made, and I have to assume that the middle and low evolutionaries would have come in there at some point anyway.
Now, Nick, you're Mr. Marvel Age podcast.
So oh, yes. I feel as I found out this week on Twitter.
So I have to bring this up to you.
Yes.
You need to bring me up to speed and tell me who is the high evolutionary and how close is the version on Spider-Man Unlimited to the actual high evolutionary.
Now, to be fair, we've only encountered the high evolutionary, I think, like once in our Marvel Age reading, because we're not reading, you know, comprehensively. The high evolutionary, back in the day in the Thor comics where he first appeared, looks kind of like this, actually. The idea is that he was an English student who took an interest in genetic biology and eventually began experimenting on rats and other different animals in an attempt to evolve them and make them more human. And eventually he moved on to counter Earth, as we see here in these pages. Now, what I don't remember in the early thing, and perhaps I'm sure if I'm wrong, certain individuals will let me know on Twitter. But I don't remember the Doomsday style shoulder pads and leg guards that he's wearing here, where it's the gray with like bits of bone sticking out. I'm not really sure what his design is all about here in the show.
Was he always a bad guy in the comics, or was he more of a misunderstood?
No, he was a bad guy.
Okay.
Now his subjects would often turn out to be misunderstood. Like it would, you know, I don't remember any of their names, but in the comics, the equivalent of Sir Ram or Lord Tiger would turn out, we've been experimented on, and we don't actually like this guy at all, and he's evil. Help us.
Well, we get that a little bit here with Lord Tiger.
A little bit of that, yeah. So, but yeah, he was always pretty much a villain.
Now,
and again, no real mention of the middle or low evolutionaries.
Now, the original
nor the high AF evolutionary.
Yes, the high AF evolutionary is very popular in California, I understand.
Colorado, various states across the Union.
The first Counter Earth, according to Wikipedia, was created by the High Evolutionary with the help of at least
popular at a Place to Be Nation WrestleMania tailgate, but that's neither here nor there.
At least some of the Infinity Gems, as part of his Project Alpha, the High Evolutionary artificially creates a Counter Earth specifically located to hide it from True Earth. In other words, not necessarily on the other side of the sun.
What are we doing?
We're here to review two episodes. So let's get to those episodes, shall we? We shall. The episodes in question, we'll start with the first one, which is episode 12 of 13, called Sins of the Fathers. Now this, of course, this title has some bearing in the Spider-Man universe. There was a Sins of the Father story arc multi-part in the animated series that came before this. But in this case, it's about Counter Mary Jane, or Karen O'Malley, as they're foolishly calling her in the show, being kidnapped by the machine men of the evolution. Now, the High Evolutionary Nick, you have to say, has a lot of different levels of goons that it's hard to differentiate. It's hard to keep track of, right? Because you've got the bestials, the lowly subjects. You've got the machine men, apparently, which I don't even know about, who are sentinels, basically, right? And then you've got the Knights of Wundagar, which are like his, you know, his right-hand creatures. So these are the machine men, the sentinels of sorts, and they kidnap Karen, and they bring her to, what is it called, Castle Wundagar or Mount Wundagar? What's it called, Nick?
Castle Wundagar, as has popped up on the screen in comic book style.
Yes.
Letterboxes from time to time.
Yes, and they take her there. They try to interrogate her, and then the High Evolutionary discovers, to his surprise, that she is his long-lost granddaughter.
Yes.
Who he had experimented on in the womb. And we find out through flashback that his son, in disgust, took his wife and daughter and left and abandoned the High Evolution.
Did we ever find out what exactly it was that he did to her?
No, just that he experimented upon her, and apparently his experiments led to her having these preternaturally great instincts and these reflexes that allow her to be a great fighter and a great warrior. But we don't know exactly what the experiments were or whether she has powers or what the hell the deal is. Mm. It's all left unspoken. And, you know, I guess getting into this review, the first thing I have to say, Nick, as I fired up this episode, I have to give this show credit for one thing.
Yes?
The intro is pretty cool with the Steve Ditko-inspired art from the early days of Spider-Man. The
only problem is the version of Peter Parker they draw here looks nothing like the version of Peter Parker in the show, to the point where the first time I saw it, I was like, who the hell is that?
Yeah, the intro looks just like Steve Ditko's Peter Parker. It's done as a direct homage to Ditko. But then once they get into the footage of the actual show, totally different. Looks much more like the previous 1994 animated series than it does like the Steve Ditko comics. And throughout this, one little minor cool thing was the comic book captions that will pop up occasionally, narrative captions for setting the location. I thought that was kind of cool. It reminded me of the video game Comic Zone for the Genesis, if you ever played that, Nick.
Yes. Yeah, who didn't?
It was good. Very difficult, too. So, what are your thoughts on this intro? Do you agree with me that it was a pretty cool intro and a nice nod to the comics?
The animation is okay, I guess, but you also have this very like late 90s kind of like borderline techno dance club kind of thing going on for the theme song. It sounds kind of like the classic Mortal Kombat theme that
Mortal
was used
Kombat.
In that's kind of what it sounds like, and you know it's by like even 1999, I have to think that kind of thing was fading out of popularity. So I don't know. I mean, there's some good, there's some bad in the intro, which is more than we can say for the rest of the show, I suppose.
Yes. So once we get into the show itself, it's all downhill from there.
Yeah, it's awful.
The animation is not good. It's very slow. The animation actually looks a little bit like the first few episodes of the X-Men animated series in terms of...
From 7 years earlier.
Just kind of slow. You know, it's smooth to a degree, but it's very slow, and the character models are
all the edges are very rounded. Like they just kind of look, you know, just overly cartoony.
And it wouldn't have been out of place as like a late 80s cartoon, really.
Right.
It sometimes reminds me a little bit of that old show Cops, if you remember that, COPS.
Yeah, vaguely.
With Misdemeanor, which is a great name.
I mean, the color palettes are completely different, but just in terms of like the style of the animation, it doesn't look unlike Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles at times as well.
Yeah, that's fair. That's totally fair. So, you know, we get to see this kind of jarring animation that is uninteresting action scenes. Holy crap. This cartoon, obviously, was a
climactic action sequence in the damn castle, where Spider-Man is just running up and down hallways. I was like, what is he even trying
to do? What about when he grabs Karen and he rescues her from her dungeon room that she's stored in? knocks out the guard, grabs her, swings, even though they're in a hallway where there's barely any room to swing from in the first place, because the roof is pretty low, but still shoots his web and swings, goes into a room. Then you see the High Evolutionary come back into the original hallway, and then Spider-Man comes out of the room and goes, uh-oh, like he went into the wrong room.
Or what about, like, at one point he's fighting robots and you just see, like, Karen run across in the background. This is before, like, he's even rescued her. And you're like, wait a minute, she's supposed to be in prison. Why is she just running around? It makes no sense.
The action scenes are brutal throughout. And you know, one of the staples of these cartoons in the era were the pre-commercial cliffhangers, right?
Oh, yes.
Every commercial break had a cliffhanger.
Dramatic music and everything.
Yeah, there were some great ones. I remember an episode of the Spider-Man series that I always think of when he was fighting Tombstone, perhaps for the first time, and all of this gas is filling the room up. And clearly Spider-Man's eating his chili that day. And as the gas is coming up, he's like, we got to get out of here, Tombstone. We'll both perish or be destroyed, or some word that isn't died because they couldn't say that. And then Tombstone puts him in a bear hug and says, joke's on you, Spider-Man. I don't breathe. And, you know, that's a good cliffhanger because, you know, oh, he doesn't breathe. What the hell? But in this show, the cliffhangers are the worst cliffhangers I've ever seen in my life. It's like all these robots are generally flying in Spider-Man's direction. Oh, gosh, what are they going to do now? And then they come back from the break and they just fly right by him. Huh.
And Spider-Man just swings by him.
They just go, huh, okay. Or in the beginning of this episode, when Karen is first attacked by the Sentinel creatures, the Machine Men, this kindly reverend saves her, right? Pushes her out of the way. And the Sentinel is going to stomp on the reverend right before the commercial break. And he goes, ah! And when they come back, some other random dude just comes in out of nowhere and shoves him aside and saves him. And that other random dude, by the way, is Peter, who is a photographer at this point, and saves the guy just by shoving him out of the way. And then it's on to the next one. Other great cliffhangers include the shocking cliffhanger of what is going to happen now that Sir Ram has finally surrounded Spider-Man on a rooftop. Oh, well, turns out he's just going to get away.
He's just going to jump off the rooftop. Yeah. I know that's crazy for Spider-Man, but there you are.
Really bad stuff here. Not very intriguing, not very interesting.
And the, you know, the cliffhangers, the animation, all that stuff is bad. The dialogue is almost equally bad, including an all-time great insult from Karen towards the High Evolutionary, where she says, suck an egg, butt brain.
Yeah, suck an egg, butt brain, which is a good insult. And it would be almost topped in the next episode when a random bystander refers to one of the bestials as a pumpkin head. You lousy pumpkin head.
Not since Kurt Busiek and Parrish Forbid have we seen dialogue this great, Greg.
You're trolling again, Nick. You're fishing. Karen O'Malley. That's totally different. Karen O'Malley
and Kevin Owens.
The rest of her ragtag group of rebels. They go and they rally to try to save her in this episode by attacking Castle Wundagar. But the High Evolutionary has other plans. He wants to complete what he says he started with Karen all those years ago when she was a fetus. He wants to turn her into an animal creature.
A bestial, yes.
For some reason, the noble animals, and that's what reminded me of our column, because apparently in the first episode there was a lot of talk of the noble animals. Mm-hmm. So the High Evolutionary believes that Karen will be happier if she is a noble animal, like the other bestials, and that humans are beneath contempt, essentially. So obviously Karen doesn't want to go along with this, and they fight, and the High Evolutionary in this show has just abnormally ridiculous powers. He can't be stopped, it seems. He's telekinetic. He's got gloves on. He's got shoulder pads, as Nick mentioned. I don't know what they do, but the guy's just very powerful. Spider-Man can't beat him, certainly.
He's got awesome facial hair.
He does. And the whole while, now don't get me wrong, one of the joys of Spider-Man is the fact that he cracks wise in the face of danger, right? He cuts jokes. He talks a lot, but Nick, in this show, he never shuts up. He could be shot in the chest with a cannon, and he's still going to say, boy, that'll leave a mark. Next time I want to take a bumpy ride like this, just take me to Coney Island.
Yeah.
Hey, how about this creepy line? So he's talking about, I wonder how John's going to take the news that Karen's been taken. Because you see, John has been pining for Karen. They have kind of an on-again, off-again love thing, apparently. And then Peter goes, because if you ask me, when it comes to Karen, he's got a lot more on his mind than the rebellion. Not that I can blame him.
Oh.
He's forgetting all about old Mary Jane, ain't he?
Yes, he has. Yes, he has. He has moved right on. Mary Jane is on the other side of the sun, for God's sake.
Yeah. What happens on the other side of the sun stays on the other side of the sun.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, if he went to counter Las Vegas, since it's counter Las Vegas, would anything that happens in counter Las Vegas go everywhere else?
Everywhere else, yes. Everything that happens in Vegas is known by everyone.
It's known by everyone. It's actually broadcast to the entire world.
Counter Brock Lesnar is a math teacher.
No, counter Brock Lesnar is apparently Brock Lesnar's daughter.
The Spider-Man and X-51. At what point did they even name this thing X-51? I don't remember
I think there's an earlier episode that we didn't watch, you know, somewhere in the middle run, where X-51 is one of these machine. We see lots of other machine men that look like X-51, but I think X-51 has like sentience and has turned babyface for some reason.
Yeah, he's a face.
He's kind of like the Spider-Man Unlimited version of like Johnny Five, I think.
Yeah, so he calculates ways to save Spider-Man from the evils of the...
Right, but he has an actual personality and, like, sentience and stuff, where these other machine men are just, like, you know, automatons.
Correct. And the great High Evolutionary shows mercy at the end of the episode. He has a chance to kill Spider-Man and Karen, but a brief bit of his humanity is appealed to by Karen, and he says... I will finish what I started, but only when you're ready. And he allows Spider-Man to escape unharmed, which sets up our series finale, Nick. Destiny Unleashed.
God.
So apparently, Venom and Carnage have been mostly unseen the entire season to this point, even though they were the whole reason why the show happened. But now we find out why they're on Counter-Earth. They're working for the Synoptic, a mysterious symbiote creature, and they plan to unleash millions of symbiotes on the planet to finally rid it of humans, the scourge of humanity. Well, while all this is happening, the High Evolutionary decides to take his most drastic actions yet, and along with the urging of Sir Ram, who hates humans, and against the better judgment of Lord Tiger, who is sympathetic to humans, the High Evolutionary decides to attack, and he's going to destroy cities until he can capture Spider-Man. And then he's going to, once he captures Spider-Man and the Rebels, he's going to somehow use their brain waves to create a sonic weapon that will melt the brains of all humanity. And his plan works for the most part. He captures the heroes. He takes them to Mount Wundagore in very boring fashion, tells them his evil plan, puts the little tubes in their head, and he's just about to unleash his evil... Actually, he does unleash it. He unleashes his evil sonic weapon. But as he does, Spider-Man luckily figures out that his suit has a sonic frequency that can counteract the sonic weapon. Perhaps because he is from regular Earth instead of counter Earth. So his sonic wavelengths disrupt the frequency of the High Evolutionary's sonic wavelengths and ruin the High Evolutionary's plan. And then we get a big knockdown, drag out Donnybrook as the heroes and the villains collide. and the Green Goblin, the counter Green Goblin shows up, who's a good guy, of course. And he shows up, and he saves Spider-Man from certain doom, and they take on the Evolutionary, the High Evolutionary, that is. And he is eventually knocked unconscious. That's right, he has a weakness after all, and it's being bumped up against a wall that is slightly electric. He falls over, unconscious. Sir Ram is knocked unconscious, and Lord Tiger allows Spider-Man and the heroes to escape. But before they leave, they stop to save Eddie Brock and serial killer Cletus Kasady from captivity.
No man left behind, Greg.
And as they do this, Eddie Brock informs Spider-Man of the bad news. Now that they have been separated from Venom and Carnage, respectively, there was the Synoptic is not happy, and the Synoptic had a fail-safe that if Eddie Brock was separated from Venom, or Kasady from Carnage, that it would create this disastrous moment. So this last-ditch effort. And so the last thing that happens on this show is we see from the Earth's core, seemingly, gigantic turds shooting up into the sky and filling New York City. The whole skyline is filled with strings of turds. Nick, it was a literal shitstorm to end this episode.
A literal shitstorm. And you're sitting there going, oh my God, what's going to happen with this shitstorm? And the series, not the episode, but the series ends with the shitstorm.
With the shitstorm. And there's nothing indicating, by the way, that it's the end of the episode. There's no to be continued. There's no dramatic music. It's just shitstorm and then credits.
Credits.
What happens? Does the shitstorm just destroy the Earth, Counter-Earth? Is Spider-Man stuck there to die a slow, miserable death? Is he going to get invaded by a symbiote? What's going to happen here, Nick? I don't know. I mean, certainly we can speculate, but needless to say, this was not even an effective cliffhanger.
No, it doesn't make any sense.
This was one of the worst episodes of anything that you'll see. I mean, it's bad. Real bad.
It really was. The whole thing is uninteresting, and then it ends. Like, again, it would be one thing if this was just a random episode, but this was the series, the season and series finale that just ends with poop flying through the air out of the top of Castle Wundagore.
Seemingly, the second season was going to pick up on this cliffhanger and reveal what all was going to be the fallout of this Synoptic plan, but despite the second season, or at least a part of the second season being written, it was never actually produced. The show was canceled, despite them essentially ending their series on a cliffhanger. And so we never got to see what happened with the shitstorm and Venom and Carnage and the Knights of Wundagore and all that good stuff. Sadly, Greg, the fate of Counter-Earth remains a mystery to us all.
Oh, my gosh. Well, let me ask. Let's ask first of all, let's talk about the purported plan for season two and some of the ideas that were out there.
You know, you were sitting there. You were sitting there for a minute. It made me wonder. You know, the way you were speaking made me wonder if there was a counter Paul Feinbaum who would say, "Baron Salee, High Evolutionary."
Oh man, counter Paul Feinbaum talking about the High Evolutionary's politics.
No, counter Paul Feinbaum would actually be well reasoned and intelligent and informed on any topic he talked about.
Cecil Hurt, Sir Ram. I mean, Sir Ram, has his production really matched his level of talk in recent seasons? Anyway, so they were going to beat the Synoptic and the High Evolutionary and Sir Ram, only to find out that Venom and Carnage had been merged into the awesome villain known as King Carnage.
There you go.
I wish we could have seen that, Nick.
Oh, how awesome would that have been? Maybe it would have been like a red and black striped kind of deal going on.
Yeah.
Who knows?
We also missed out on a chance to discover the counter Black Cat. Would you like to know more about this, Nick?
Yeah. Whether I do or not, I think you're going to tell me.
Spider-Man has to discover the culprit behind a series of daring robberies and discovers that the villain is not one, but three Black Cats bestial Siamese cat sisters who are beautiful, charming, and deadly.
Oh, God. Beautiful and deadly and animals. And man, then, somebody had a furry thing going on back in these days, I'm pretty sure.
And then if you're ready for your head to explode, Nick, what happens when a world that already has a counter Mary Jane has another actual counter Mary Jane?
Oh, man.
Because to cash in on the new social situation, this is going to be episode 17, Model Behavior, a bestial movie producer offers Spidey a deal to star. Are you ready for this, Nick? In a in a human exploitation film. Peter is reluctant until he discovers that Counter-Earth's version of Mary Jane is one of the actresses vying to be his co-star. I mean, this just sounds wonderful.
It really does. Why wasn't this made?
I don't know. Now, granted, it would have to overcome the central problem of the show, which is that bestials are inherently uninteresting.
Yes.
This show, Nick, I thought perhaps, well, it had a whole season to find its footing. Maybe it's better than it was when it started, but by God.
It might actually be worse.
Oh, dreadful. I will say Sins of the Fathers was not as bad an episode as Destiny Unleashed. Destiny Unleashed was everything that was bad about the pilot, and maybe, like you said, a little bit worse.
Ramped up a little bit.
Just dreadful. Just awful.
Yeah, I mean, really nothing redeeming about it. I can't find anything to recommend about this show.
To the high evolutionary.
The high evolutionary's semen can cure leprosy. I wish I had leprosy.
There's a toenail on the end of the high evolutionary's penis.
The high evolutionary sired a baseball team, an orchestra if you count the bastards.
If you drop a phonograph needle on the high evolutionary's nipple, it plays the Beach Boys. That's all.
Oh, God. Did I ever tell you about the time the high evolutionary rode me to win the Kentucky Derby?
Sir Ram molested me.
Oh, God.
Anyway, we go out drinking and sit down in an empty alley. Sure enough, someone constructed a bar around us. Anyway, the place opens. Brasky orders one shot. And then
you mean the High Evolutionary?
To the crowd, yes. Brasky is actually the real name of the High Evolutionary. High Evolutionary says over the roar of the flames, always leave things the way you found them. To the High Evolutionary.
To the High Evolutionary.
Well, with that said, folks, we want to hear your thoughts on the High Evolutionary, the Low Evolutionary, yeah, the Middle Evolutionary, and everything in between, every type of evolutionary. Let us know your thoughts on Spider-Man Unlimited. Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Send us a smoke signal if you'd like. Use the Ho-Ho Loon ticker to let us know what's going on. We will be interested to know your thoughts. Now, we're going to take a little break-a-rooney here. When we come back, we will have, for the first time in a while, the rundown. We will have reading and watching, and we will have the wrestling minute. So we're going to take a break, and we will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceofNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceofNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceofNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. And we here at the Ho-Ho Loon Plaza in the Hard Traveling Studios are happy you're still with us. We are now going to give you the news and notes in the world of comic books. It's a little segment that we like to call Our Client, the Rundown.
Welcome to the Rundown.
Was that Paul Heyman?
Yes.
Or Raymond Babbitt in Rain Man?
definitely Heyman. Definitely my client, Brock Lesnar. Black Widow. The movie is coming out soon, and they finally released the damn trailer for it. Comes out in April, and the first trailer has hit, and by and large, another successful Marvel trailer. People are buzzing about this movie now.
Mm-hmm.
ScarJo looks amazing as always, and looks like she's going to inhabit this character very well. Going off to Russia for the setting, it appears. We also got a look at her sister in the movie. We also got a look at David Harbour as Red Guardian, who I know nothing about, Nick.
I believe he's just supposed to be one of the many attempts at recreating the super soldier serum that Russia, you know, during the Cold War and all that kind
of
stuff.
Good guy, bad guy, who knows? But, well, people that read the comics know, but I've not read any Black Widow comics. But anyway, this trailer, Nick, what were your thoughts?
I liked it. Liked it a lot, actually. Got some good stuff with David Harbour in there, who I know. It's interesting because when we talked earlier offline, I was surprised because, you know, a superhero dealing with weight issues is the quickest way to your heart,
yes,
typically. But yes, you were not in on this David Harbour stuff.
Yeah, and I'll get into that a little bit. Number one, he's not fat enough to qualify for me, Nick, for the fat superhero thing. Need him a little bit more rotund. You know, I'm thinking like a who was the big kid, the big offensive lineman from Varsity Blues?
Billy Bob was his name.
Yeah, him. He'd be a good one. But no, I think my issue with the David Harbour character is not. It's going to be great. Mm-hmm. It's going to be good. I understand that it was funny and he'll be very good in it, and I'm sure it'll be a great movie. In fact, it's a Marvel movie. However, I must confess that the David Harbour character's appearance of Red Guardian kind of disrupted my vibe in this trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Because the general tone and tenor of the trailer in the beginning is sort of like a Jason Bourne movie. Like, it's very gritty. It's very, you know, self-reflective. Seems very much, rather than it being a superhero movie, it seems very much like what I was hoping they would do, which is like a more straight spy movie. Spy, espionage, action movie. That is very light on the superheroics, if it's there at all. And all that's fine, and then this dude shows up in this giant superhero, red superhero costume, Red Guardian, looking like he stepped off the set of Astro City or something. And that's fine. It's a great costume. It's a great universe that they've built here. However, from what I was thinking the movie was going to be, it was a little bit disappointing, only because the vibe that the trailer had to that point, I was like, shit, this is like a James Bond for women. This is like a James Bond for, you know, a new generation. And it doesn't kind of feel that way necessarily having finished the entire trailer. Although there certainly are some cool Bond stunts in this movie. We know that. So it's going to ultimately be a Marvel movie, a James Bond movie filtered through Marvel superheroes. So that makes sense to a degree, I suppose. But I still like the trailer. But what I told you off the air was it kind of like it was a little disappointing to me just because of the idea that I had built in my head of what this movie could be in terms of being different from the MCU. Instead, it's clear we're still going to have the same kind of overall vision to the movie that we've had to the other movies.
Now, I had it on good authority that you're not supposed to let your internal image of what you want the movie to be affect how you view the finished product.
True, but I'm not reviewing the finished product. I'm reviewing the trailer. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that once the final movie comes out, unlike you, I'll be able to put my feelings aside and just acknowledge that if it's a good movie, just acknowledge that it's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And not hold a lifelong bitter resentment towards the director of the film and want to wish ill will and harm upon him.
I don't wish any ill will or harm upon this individual.
You hired a hitman to take out Taika Waititi.
Well, he was very expensive, and I had to scrounge up the Beskar steel, which is hard to come by in this galaxy, but I eventually found it.
You're saying this is the way?
This is the way.
In any event, good trailer. I'm probably a little lower on it than most people just because of that element, but I do think it's going to be a great movie regardless. Too many good actors, too many interesting settings, and even if it can come close to mimicking the closest thing we've seen to this point, which would be Captain America, the Winter Soldier, then we know it'll be a top level movie because that's one of the all time best for Marvel. So,
mm-hmm.
Interesting nonetheless. Anything to add on this topic, Nick?
No, I like the trailer. Look forward to the movie.
Well, let's move on over to a different sort of television property, and that is, some news came out this past week that Legendary Television has signed a deal to produce a TV series based on Frank Miller's Sin City. But rather than sort of a reboot of Sin City, if you will, it appears that this is going to be tied in to the previous movies because Frank Miller will produce the series and director Robert Rodriguez, who has directed the previous two movies, will join him as a producer. The deal is contingent upon finding a network or streaming service to air it, but it will also include an R-rated animated Sin City feature. So I thought that
was... an animated feature. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I should have read the entire report, apparently.
Previously, a deal had been struck to bring Sin City to TV with former The Walking Dead showrunner Glenn Mazzara, although that never materialized.
Okay.
So no time frame on this, but listen, we were just talking about this off the air. We're fans of both the Sin City movies. I think the first one is clearly better, but the second movie was better than perhaps its reputation is. I enjoyed it a great deal. So
yeah, I mean, by the very nature of what the movies have been with the anthology type feel to them, you know, they're going to have a little bit of inconsistency, and I think the lows in the second one are undoubtedly lower than the lows from the first one, but I think some of the better vignettes or stories from that second movie is right up there with the good stuff from the first one.
Yeah, it was an enjoyable movie. So I've really loved, I still remember one of the best theater experiences really of my life was that first Sin City movie. It really blew my mind first time I saw it with my friends in college. And so I'm excited to see this sort of aesthetic come to television. I think it can be it could certainly find a good audience perhaps on an HBO or a Cinemax or Stars or somewhere like that, or even a streaming service like Netflix, or perhaps, you know, something along the lines of DC Universe or something that's more niche. I don't know if it's...
Yeah, where was Sin City published originally?
I don't even know. I don't believe... Now that I think about it, I don't think it was a Vertigo property. I think it was an independent series. Maybe Dark Horse that actually published it. Yeah, it was Dark Horse. So,
okay.
One of the streaming services...
So there's no existing tie to, like... You know, so like Warner Brother, DC didn't publish it, so it's not like a natural fit for HBO Max or something, which isn't to say it couldn't wind up on HBO Max through a licensing deal, but I'm saying that doesn't, you know, kind of stand out as the obvious home.
Well, speaking of obvious homes, there have been a lot of rumors about the home of the Stargirl series that had been long in the works on DC Universe. Mm-hmm. Well, now we finally have gotten official word on this. DC Universe will still be the home of Stargirl, the series. However, the CW has signed on to air episodes of Stargirl a day after they premiere on the streaming platform. The episodes will also be added to the CW's free digital platforms as well. This will be the second DC Universe show that will be shared with other WarnerMedia platforms, joining Doom Patrol, which will also be on the HBO Max streaming service. So Stargirl, we originally thought was going to come out this year, but has been pushed back to 2020, and DC is stating that it will debut in the spring of 2020. So sort of a late season ad for the CW here in Stargirl, Nick.
Yeah, this is very interesting. You know, and I guess I should count myself upon as somebody who falls into this category, but it makes you wonder what the long – again, I know I've been saying this for a long time. I really wonder what the long-term future of DC Universe is, because now Titan – or excuse me, Doom Patrol, which is supposed to be one of the big service sellers, is moving over to HBO Max. Now, granted, it's still going to appear on DC Universe, but you can get it on HBO Max. Stargirl now, you don't even need a subscription to anything. You can get this over the air for nothing. So this is a weird move. This is an interesting move, though, because remember, all the DC Universe properties, original properties at this point, with the exception of Young Justice, have been fairly adult-oriented and, you know, something that wouldn't necessarily fly on broadcast television. With this now, we know they're going to have to clean it up for CW airing.
Yeah, and also this opens the door to, rather than tying into the existing properties of Doom Patrol and Titans, is it possible that this show ties into the Arrowverse?
I would think it would have to, right? I mean, especially if you believe, as you and I do, that the eventual outcome of Crisis on Infinite Earths is that everything plays on the same Earth.
Yeah, very interesting stuff at play here. And also, I do think it's a good thing in the realm of, we've talked about this before, that there should be a variety of audiences served by these properties. We've talked about it with movies, etc. In other words, not every tone is appropriate for every character. So, yes, the adult-oriented Swamp Thing was fine. Yes, the adult-oriented Doom Patrol is fine. Even to a degree, they've made Titans work, being more adult-oriented.
To a degree.
But Stargirl is one that you probably don't need to be on there dropping F-bombs and having people decapitated and all that stuff. And I think that's a good thing if they're able to produce a show on the same platform that has these other shows that are more hard-hitting and show that, yeah, we can also put a family-friendly show on there. So if that's the case, which I think it will be, then I think that's a really good move, and it shows understanding of the characters, which is key.
Yep.
And nobody has shown better stewardship outside of the MCU of comic book characters than has the CW with its Arrowverse. So we finally this week have gotten the final trailer predating the premiere next week of Crisis on Infinite Earths, this extremely exciting crossover event that will encompass Arrow, The Flash, Batwoman, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, and characters from Black Lightning, from Birds of Prey, from Smallville, and even from Batman the Animated Series, seemingly. So, what a trailer, Nick. I watched this at work today after you let me know that it existed. This was amazing. It was almost emotionally overwhelming for me. It was almost akin to when I saw the Avengers trailer years ago. Not quite maybe to that level, but pretty damn close. And I told my boss, I was like, honestly, this has stolen the day from Black Widow for me. I was like, I was just in heaven because as a DC fan. And,
So tell me, did you take this as a trailer for the overall event or a trailer for like, I kind of took it as just a trailer for like the first hour for just the Supergirl episode.
Oh, wow. I took it for the entire event, but maybe you're right.
No, because there's that scene in the trailer where they specifically mention like, we're here on Earth 38 to make our stand or whatever, which is the Supergirl Earth. Which, and I think you and I all believe, I think everybody believes that eventually the event, the story is going to move back to Earth 1, the main Earth. and that's going to be the kind of the last thing. So, and plus they talk about bringing together these seven heroes from across the multiverse. You would have to think that would have to happen pretty early in the event so you could get into the actual, you know, battle against the Anti-Monitor and stuff. So I kind of took this as a trailer for maybe just like the first, either the first episode or the first half of the event before the big cliffhanger that we all know is coming to lead into January.
Either way, there's a lot to unpack here, and that's the reason why I thought it was for the event, because there's so much happening here. We see Iris. One of the things that stood out to me, Iris gets wiped out in a wave of red antimatter at one point. So that's interesting. We see Superman goes around to round up the Clark Kent of the Smallville Earth, and we see Tom Welling look up to him and kind of confused, and the guy says, "You are Clark Kent, right?" And then the moment that might have gotten me, that one got me, but the one that might have gotten me the most of all was for the first time ever hearing Kevin Conroy speaking in live action as Bruce Wayne on a show.
Mm-hmm.
When he says, "Kate," with the Batman voice. Oh,
yes.
My God, Nick.
Yes.
This looks amazing. No other way to describe it. I hope it can live up to the hype, but quite honestly, this trailer has given me such a feeling of euphoria. Plus,
you got to remember, Guggenheim is out there saying that like there are other cameos that haven't been revealed yet. There still are some secrets in the hopper to be pumped out to us. So much stuff that can still happen. I know how busy he is with his. You know, there's a little movie coming out in a few weeks that you know Mark Hamill is going to be involved in. But I hope they're able to get at least a very brief involvement from Mark Hamill.
God. And he has been on The Flash before.
He's been on Flash. You could easily use him as an older Joker would be amazing for just a nod or something. So many different things you could do.
And we've still got hope for Kathy Lee Crosby.
Kathy Lee Crosby, that's right. Linda Carter.
Unfortunately, Ricardo Montalban is dead, but what about the creepy henchman guy? He's probably still alive.
Tattoo?
No. No. Anyway, this is going to be great. Can't wait for it. Sounds awesome. Something else that was great was the Joker movie by Todd.
Yeah, we got a slew of DC news.
Yes, the director Todd Phillips.
Or not even really news, just speculation from the last couple of weeks since we haven't had a rundown in a while.
Yeah, the Joker was wild. As everybody knows, the Joker was wildly successful. The most financially successful comic book movie of all time, in fact.
Relative to, you know, in terms of
yes.
budget leading to profit.
Yes, most profitable. And a wild success. I loved it. I thought it was in the running for the best movie I saw all year. And Todd Phillips, though, is denying rumors that surfaced over the last few weeks that we didn't cover that he had inked a deal with Warner Brothers for a Joker sequel and also several other similar films for other DC characters, origin films. He says now that is flat out false, but that he's open to the idea. I'll just read the quote here. "Well, a movie doesn't make $1 billion and they don't talk about a sequel. Joaquin and I have publicly stated that we've been talking about a sequel since week two of shooting because it's a fun thing to talk about. But the Hollywood Reporter article was referring to other things that were just frankly untrue. I don't know how it got started, if it's some assistant trying to gain street cred with a writer." No meeting.
You know what I take from that?
Ever happened on October 7th where I marched in. And he also did confirm that when he pitched Joker to the studio, it was part of an entire slate of DC films he wanted to do. However, they shot it down quickly. He says, quote, "Who am I to walk in and start a label at a film studio? They said, let's do this one." And his next announced film is a Hulk Hogan biopic starring Chris Hemsworth.
Yes! The greatest film of all time.
Is it just going to be called Hogan?
I don't know what it's going to be called. It's going to be called Arcing Ropes of Jism here at the Nick Duke household, I'll tell you that.
Yep.
But in any event, you know what I take from all that he just said?
What's that?
That a Joker sequel is going to happen.
Probably, yeah. Almost assuredly. I mean, it would be impossible for it not to with how much money it made, right?
With the amount of money it made and the fact that both he and Joaquin Phoenix seem open to doing it, it pretty much is going to happen. I don't really see any way it doesn't, right?
Now, here's the question, Nick. Is there any way that would be satisfying creatively from a fandom standpoint or just from a even taking it just from a fan of the movie standpoint, for that to work?
I don't know. You know, because you
we
and
didn't
I
think the movie would work in the first place, granted.
Yeah, exactly. So how are we – we're not very good judges of what's going to work with this particular approach to the character. I mean, given
I love the
creative the
movie's
success,
ambiguity so much, you know.
Yes, but I think you can carry that forward in a way from there. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. It'll be interesting to see the attempt at the very least.
Yes, absolutely.
Which gets into the next question is, can you do a sequel to that movie without Batman? Or do you save that for a potential third film? I don't know.
Which also leads to another question, Nick.
Yes.
Do you smell what The Rock is cooking?
Huh. I do. But before we move on, one more thing. The other aspect of that, the rumor about the line of films that he would oversee, I'm not necessarily totally opposed to that.
No, not at all.
Joker. As a matter of fact, wouldn't a Lex Luthor movie in today's day and age, given the current political climate in our country, make a hell of a lot of sense?
Yes, it would. I mean, and we've actually seen this exact line play out in the comics, where around the time of Joker Fever in 2008-ish or so, I believe there was a book that came out. Maybe it was a little bit before that, but there was a book that came out by, I think, by Brian Azzarello and Lee Bermejo called Joker. And they later did a book called Luther.
Luther, yep.
So we could see a very similar thing here. I believe a Lex Luthor film could be utterly tremendous in this day and time. I mean, and that's not to limit it to just those two characters, but certainly that would be preferable to another Superman movie with another shitty take on Lex Luthor. So,
no, we just need to bring back Eisenberg.
Oh God. And then, you know, imagine a Todd Phillips helmed Sinestro movie. Interesting. Is it not?
I doubt that would happen.
Almost assuredly not. It doesn't have enough cash culturally, but we can dream, right?
I'm trying to think who else he would do besides those. I mean,
a bunch of Batman villains.
Oh, a dream.
Dent.
A Two-Face movie.
Dent. He can do it. Cobblepot,
yes. Yes. And get, I don't even know who you would get. Do it as an animated movie with Nolan North doing the voice as he did in the Arkham series.
Or just do they're totally different universes. Michael Caine as an old man penguin.
As an old man penguin as like the framing sequence that opens and closes the movie.
Now listen here. You might be asking yourself, how'd a guy that looks like you, or sounds like you, end up in Gotham? Well, let me tell you the story. It's quite funny, actually. Work out.
It could.
But, you know, I ask you if you smell what The Rock is cooking for a very simple reason, Nick.
Yes.
And that is that we found out more news about the Black Adam movie this past week, and that is that the Justice Society of America will be in New Line Cinema's Black Adam. This is according to Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He revealed this during the press junket for Jumanji, the new one that's coming out. And they are going to have the JSA in Black Adam. He just kind of casually dropped it. They're introducing the JSA in the movie. And so there are going to be a lot of happy Justice Society fans out there, Nick. And I think you and I are probably right now at the peak of our Justice Society fandom, coming on the heels of reading The Golden Age recently.
Yes, and also what's exciting about the Justice Society being introduced in this is it further sets the stage for a more cohesive DC universe on film going forward, which, again, I've been really pleased with the most recent efforts from DC, whether it be Shazam or Aquaman or Joker, as we referenced earlier. But there's still a part of me that wants to see a fully realized DC universe on screen, and I think getting legacy characters like perhaps Jay Garrick or Alan Scott in there could be our first steps towards that.
Wouldn't it be absolutely wild if, after they failed to build a cinematic universe around Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, that they succeed in building a cinematic universe around Shazam, Black Adam, and the Justice Society?
That would be cool. And then work in Aquaman and Wonder Woman, yeah, you know, as they go. I don't know.
Utterly wild, man. Well, speaking of wild, the cast list for the Matt Reeves movie, The Batman. This is getting interesting, Nick. It's almost like they're just picking people at random now, but John Turturro of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou and other movies, but primarily Oh Brother, Where Art Thou for our purposes.
And that, no, wait a minute. Don't forget that, was it the Stephen King one? What's it called?
A Johnny Depp movie, right?
Yeah. What
You Stole My Story.
Yeah, I don't know what the movie was actually called, but we call it You Stole My Story.
Yes. I'll be.
Why do I want to say Secret Window? That doesn't sound right, though.
I'll be 84. But I'll only be 82.
What does that have to do with anything? Yeah, Secret Window is what it was called.
Yeah.
It was based on the novella Secret Window, Secret Garden by Stephen King.
I have it on good authority here that he is going to be playing Carmine Falcone in the movie. And I understand that he's going to meet Batman in a restaurant in Gotham early in the film. And they're going to be sitting down across from one another, Bruce Wayne and Carmine Falcone. And he's going to issue a stern warning to Bruce. And he's going to tell him, do not seek the treasure. And then Bruce is going to say, I don't understand. He's going to say, do not seek the treasure. Do you feel do you understand this as well, Nick? Do you feel that's where they're going?
Do you think Carmine will have, or Carmine Falcone will have a cousin, Walter Falcone?
I think that would be good. I think that'd be a good thing to add into the movie if they don't have it already in the script.
Mm-hmm.
You keep calling him Walter.
With a wife who is R-U-N-N-O-F-T.
They got to get Tim Blake Nelson in this movie, right? They just have
Absolutely. Absolutely. David Sunday is listening to this part of the podcast going, I just don't get it.
Well, speaking of projects that people haven't gotten over the years, Green Lantern. Our beloved Green Lantern. For the first time, Nick.
Greg, is it possible we are about to enter the golden era of Green Lantern on film?
Probably not.
This and the television show. The television show is happening, though. That's really true. Seems like it's happening.
For the first time, I was going to say, for the first time in 10 years, almost literally 10 years.
It feels like there's hope.
We are getting good news about Green Lantern properties outside the comics.
Yes.
So, here's the report. The long gestating Geoff Johns written Green Lantern Corps movie remains a priority for Warner Brothers, according to Variety. Johns is expected to finish a new script by the end of 2019. Hopefully a new script that isn't constantly rewritten to the point that it no longer resembles the original script. Meanwhile, we talked recently about the very exciting news that Green Lantern Corps is going to, that Green Lantern is going to be an HBO Max series.
Yes.
However, new news indicates that Geoff Johns is reportedly working with Greg Berlanti on that show.
Yes.
So, interesting stuff here. The original Geoff Johns Green Lantern Corps announcement in 2018 named Hal Jordan and John Stewart as the leads of the film. So, we also found out that Berlanti and J.J. Abrams are rumored as possibilities to be enlisted by Warner Brothers for the GLC film. Now, Nick, this is a lot of good news here. Geoff Johns working on the TV series with Berlanti. Geoff Johns working on the movie. J.J. Abrams in consideration for the movie. A lot of interesting things at play here, but again, for the first time in a long time, is there reason to be hopeful now?
It seems that way, doesn't it? Now, granted, we're going to all get our hopes up, and HBO Max is going to go out of business before it ever gets launched, and Geoff Johns is going to fall out of favor again, and none of this is ever going to wind up happening. But at this moment, as we sit here, it seems like it's closer than it's ever been.
We can only cross our fingers right now and hope that the both of the projects happen and that both of the projects are worthy of the Green Lantern title.
Isn't it kind of crazy that, like, so the movie was announced and has allegedly been in development since, what, 2015, if I remember correctly, something like that. 60. Yeah. The TV show was announced a month ago, and yet if we had to place bets on which one is more likely to happen,
well, the TV show,
we would all say
the
television show. Yeah. Which is nuts.
Well, here's another aspect. If the movie is still happening, and if Hal Jordan and Jon Stewart are still the leads of the film, does that mean that the TV show will not follow either of those characters?
I wonder if the television show might not be like an anthology type. I don't know. It's just, there's so many interesting directions you can go.
The most important thing, Nick, is it further opens the door for the possibility,
yes,
of Guy Gardner.
Of Guy Gardner. Absolutely. Let's do it.
I mean, The Rock is not doing Ballers anymore for HBO.
No, he's not. Oh, but he's playing Black Adam, unfortunately.
Well, speaking of J.J. Abrams, I know I mentioned that he may be directing the GLC film. They're interested in it. Well, apparently they're also interested in him doing the next Superman film.
Variety. Which they were interested in years ago, back in the early 2000s.
Yes, Flyby, the long talked about Flyby script, which I've read portions of, and weighing out with his hands, Gary Danielson noise,
Chris Collinsworth
noise, Tony Romo noise, I don't know, but nonetheless...
Pollock still would have been better than Superman Returns.
Abrams has been in discussions with Warner Brothers Pictures, according to Variety. We don't know that this is going to happen. Nothing's official, just conversations. But very curious that originally, when Abrams had developed and written the Superman Flyby script, Henry Cavill and Amy Adams were among those auditioned to be Superman and Lois. So, kind of interesting bit of trivia there. So, do you think this ever happens, Nick? And do you want it to happen?
I don't think it ever happens. I think he's such a busy guy right now with so many other irons in the fire and so many other interesting projects he probably work on. And plus, I think there have been so many conflicting reports to this juncture about what the actual nature of Superman at Warner Brothers is going to be going forward. We've heard everything from Michael B. Jordan. We've heard Henry Cavill still being attached. We've heard just an altogether unknown coming on and taking on the role. So until Warner Brothers has a more firm Superman strategy, I can't see anyone signing up to direct a Superman film at this point.
I agree. And to your point, another story that actually glanced over there, Henry Cavill, says that he's not done playing Superman. He feels he has unfinished business in the role. He said that Justice League didn't work, which is correct. But he said, I'm not just going to sit quietly in the dark as all this stuff is going on. I've not given up on the role. There's a lot I have yet to give it, a lot of storytelling to do. And I feel bad for the guy, because outside the second half of Justice League, he's not really had a chance to play the fully formed Superman yet.
Right.
I love Man of Steel, and I will defend it to my dying breath as a great movie. But he wasn't playing a fully developed Superman yet. And when we got that character in Batman versus Superman, it barely resembled Superman as we know him.
And then he was dead after Justice League.
Dead, yes. So I would love to see him get a shot at it. I don't think that he will. I think the studio is going to try to... I think the studio is going to try to distance itself from the previous movies. However, I think he should get an opportunity.
You're probably right, although there's a part of me that wishes they would just do another Superman movie with him and take the Halloween approach or the Terminator approach to BVS and Justice League and just pretend like they never happened. Just literally pick up where Man of Steel left off and go from there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know all the reasons they won't or can't, but I kind of wish it would happen.
Well, that brings an end to the rundown. Bit of a long rundown this week, but we had a lot on the plate, a lot to talk about. So let's move on from that and move on to our discussion of all of the various things that we've read and watched in the comic book world, a segment known half the world over, at least, I would say, Nick, as Read and Watch It. Well, gosh, Nick, you been reading anything lately?
No.
I read Doomsday Clock 11, although I can't remember if we already talked about that on the show.
I believe we did.
All right. Well, in that case, no, I haven't read anything. So let's move on to watching. Well, the CW shows have been in full swing. I am fully caught up on Arrow and The Flash. I haven't watched any of the other ones. But for the life of me, I can't remember what the last episodes were that we talked about on the show.
Nor can I. So we're just going to – yeah, we'll have to speak more generally.
Well, I think that Arrow has continued to just hit home run after home run on the Oliver Queen farewell tour. In the span since we last met, I believe we got the Farewell to Anatoly episode where Oliver returns to Russia to deal with the Bratva and his old friend Anatoly Knyetsev. And
why did I think Anatoly was dead?
I thought he was too, but I looked up on Wikipedia and I said, "Is this a continuity error?" Because I thought he died. I thought Ricardo Diaz killed him, but I looked it back up again, and he did not die. He was badly wounded, but he survived, and they gave him a fake ID to go to Bialya to live a life where the Bratva couldn't get to him anymore.
And now he's back in Russia anyway.
Now he ended up back in Russia because he says in the episode he got bored, basically. I got bored. Became bartender. And goes over there and does that. And I loved it, man. Anatoly and Oliver is one of the great relationships on this show. It really is. And so anytime they're together, it's money to me. And it actually hurt my heart that season last year when they were – or maybe it was the year before when they were kind of – put at odds with each other as enemies.
Mm-hmm.
They're just much better friends. And so I really enjoyed this episode a lot. And then they followed that with the episode that was the last episode, I think, right? Was the Anatoly episode. Am I missing one?
No, then the most recent one was the reset episode where he was in the time loop, I think.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes. That saw the farewell to Captain Lance.
Yes.
Which probably was even better than the Anatoly episode.
Oh, I think it was easily better than the Anatoly episode.
Oh, it was an
even though I liked that as well.
You want to talk about an emotional ringer, Nick. He's stuck in a time loop in an alternate world where not only did Quentin Lance never die, he becomes mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And Oliver is doomed to see him die over and over and over and over again until he can finally accept fate, accept that there's nothing he could have done to prevent this from happening. And it's all part of a test from the monitor to make Oliver aware of what's going on. Wonderful to see Quentin Lance back, wasn't it, Nick?
Oh, it was outstanding. Outstanding to get to see him back, and you get lots of moments where he interacting with Oliver, interacting with Katie Cassidy, that's one thing I got to say. For a character and an actress who we have knocked for the better part of like 8 years, she's actually wound up being a big asset to this last season of Arrow, which is kind of surprising.
Yes, I think the Black Siren arc really saved her on the show in a lot of ways because Black Siren has turned out to be a far more interesting character than Laurel Lance ever was before that, the regular Laurel Lance. And I thought her character arc of how, Lance never lost faith in her the whole time that she was doing these horrible things to the team, constantly betraying him, and yet he kept showing faith in her, and that faith ended up getting rewarded, which I thought was very cool. And we're seeing that this season, and she's doing a magnificent job to her credit. So that was great. I also have enjoyed the dynamic with Oliver and his kids, both of his kids.
Yes.
That's been really fun to watch. And then we didn't even talk about the big twist at the end of the previous episode where we find out that Lila is working with the monitor and is actually exposed by Laurel to both Diggle and Oliver. I thought that was really cool too. So a lot of interesting aspects at play here as we head barrel towards the crisis, really.
Absolutely. Can't wait.
Meanwhile, on The Flash, we have dealt a little bit more with Nash Wells and a little bit more with the Ramsey Rosso character, or Bloodwork, if you will. And as he's continued to try to take over bodies and souls and minds, and this sort of culminated. Well, we had two episodes in a row, one of which was very much Nash and Joe together, which was cool, and Barry and Ralph kind of infiltrating this party, you know, in a kind of a Bond spoof, which was funny. But then this last episode, I thought was tremendous with Bloodwind coming into the show. No, Bloodwork trapping Barry in his own mind, essentially, as he's trying to take over Barry's body, and Barry is being blocked by the Speed Force, which is trying to convince him that he needs to fight this and that he needs to just accept his fate, that he's going to die in the crisis and there's nothing he can do about it. This treats us to some of the best acting of Grant Gustin's career, which is saying a lot because he's amazing. He's always great. And it's a fucking ridiculous thing that he doesn't get to play this character on the big screen, because his acting is as good as anybody's in any of the superhero movies. So he was great here, man. It was heartbreaking when he sees Nora again and she's ripped from him again. He can't grab her. And then when he finds out that look of betrayal on his face, when he finds out that Ramsey is telling the truth, that he actually doesn't have to die if he joins Ramsey. And it also has a killer twist at the end where we learn that Barry actually did make the selfish decision here and gave in to Ramsey. And I love human heroes. I love heroes that make mistakes and can overcome those mistakes. So, yeah, I thought it was great, man. What did you make of these two episodes, and in particular the last one?
Yeah, the last episode, of course, they were all really great. The Barry and Ralph one was awesome. And then this one with the Bloodwork character. While I agree with you, I like human heroes, it felt a little – Barry has been so unselfish throughout the course of the show. It's felt a little off character for him, but I'm interested to see how they explain it and resolve it.
I thought the Nora thing pushed him over the edge. I thought that was what pushed him over the emotional edge, where he was okay, and then he literally had it in his grasp, a family,
right?
The idea that he could actually see his little girl be born and grow up and live, even though rationally we know that's not going to happen because he's going to be a mindless husk, essentially.
Right.
Really, really good stuff here around the board. And then the other shows, Nick, I'll have to turn to you two because I'm way behind on Batwoman. I haven't watched any Supergirl or Black Lightning this year.
Yeah, you gotta get caught up before the crisis. You're going to be lost when crisis starts, yeah. I'm afraid. Especially as it relates to the Kara and Lena dynamic and everything that's going on there, which seemingly is going to be a big part of crisis.
Supergirl's got bangs now.
Supergirl has bangs and pants. So there you go. Both have been good. I don't want to say too much because, in theory, you're going to watch them at some point.
Yes.
In theory. Both have been good and build momentum. Batwoman, from what I understand, has kind of hit something of a mid-season finale in its most recent episode, but I haven't watched that episode yet. They continue to flesh out the Alice stuff. You get to see the debut of Julia Pennyworth in a recent episode, which I think there's some material to be mined there. That's all I'll say. And Supergirl continues to be
Supergirl turning
pretty good
the corner
as well.
A little bit.
A little bit. I mean, I think the show, whenever it focuses on Lena and Kara, is at its best, and whenever it focuses on this new Alexandra Rojas character is at its worst. So, also, Leviathan, which has been built up as this creepy threat over the entire season, when they reveal who is actually behind it, I rolled my eyes for reasons that, like, I don't want to spoil it for you, but I think you'll understand the complaint I have whenever you finally get there.
I'm guessing that it's not the same as what the comic book reveal was.
No, it is not the same as the comic book reveal at all.
Well, in any event, you know.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to handle the fact that Crisis is going to be split up by a month, by the way? Ooh, that's going to be rough.
You got a lot of catching up to do before it even starts.
I'm aware. I know what I have to do. I know what challenges lay before me.
You better get cracking.
I'm gonna sit back. I'm gonna take a bottle of a little bit of the bubbly, and I'm gonna.
No, you're not.
Well, by bubbly I mean sparkling cider. Mm. And I'm gonna absorb all the episodes at some point.
No, you're not.
I am. I'm not gonna catch up on Black Lightning. I've given up because I'm so far behind. I one day on Netflix I might, because it's easier to watch on Netflix. A good show, nothing against the show. And then I will catch up. I will watch Supergirl at some point. And I will catch up on Batwoman. It will happen.
Okay.
Oh, ye of little faith, that is likely correct. In any event.
How's that Arkham Knight going for you?
I'm not going to dignify that with a response. But you know, Nick, speaking of no responses, I'm going to pull up my PlayStation 4 right now and see how my Arkham Knight is going. And while I do, I can't help but look at the clock over in the corner of the screen of the PS4 here. And it's telling me that it's time for the Wrestling Minute. Now, Nick, a lot's happened since last we spoke about wrestling on the show, including Survivor Series weekend, which featured TakeOver War Games from NXT, the Survivor Series from the World Wrestling Entertainment, and then, you know, Raw, SmackDown, and all the other stuff. Takeaways from TakeOver and Survivor Series.
TakeOver, as always, was a phenomenal show. Great, both the men's and women's War Games matches were outstanding. Star-making performances throughout the weekend for both Rhea Ripley, I think, predominantly, and also Keith Lee. Both of those featured heavily on both the NXT TakeOver event and then also got featured spots on Survivor Series as well. So great for them. Great for NXT, really, to be given the big push of getting the win, the overall win at Survivor Series. So good stuff there.
And stealing the show at Survivor Series with the NXT title match.
Yeah, I think arguably stealing. Yeah, probably the match of the night there. That or the men's, you know, elimination match, and kind of pick which one you like better. But, or, you know, honestly, I'm big on that triple threat with Roddy and AJ and Shinsuke Nakamura as
well.
Yes,
for the mid-card titles, that was good. That was right. Very good. Yeah, good weekend of wrestling overall. I thought Survivor Series was good. I have not watched TakeOver yet because I was otherwise occupied that Saturday night. But yet I feel confident knowing that it was a great show. I'm going to watch that when I get a chance this week. And really excited about both of the War Games matches there. And I thought it was a strong showing for NXT all weekend. Really, the build-up to that show as well. NXT looked great. They came off like huge stars. Rhea Ripley with one of the finishes of the year and her victory over Charlotte Flair. And Bayley, I think, was the other person in that match. And, so really good stuff. AEW Dynamite, I missed last week, but I did have a chance to see the main event, Chris Jericho and our boy, Scorpio Sky, hard-traveling fanboys, audio alum, Scorpio Sky, and thought it was very good. I was really proud of his effort in that match. Thought they had a good match, and Scorpio had the crowd biting on a couple of those near falls, so really cool to see that. I'm interested to go back and watch Kenny Omega versus Pac. And I also, we were talking about this off the air, I got to give credit to an act that I have been very critical of here on the show. The Dark Order vignettes, I think, have been really interesting, really well produced. So credit to AEW for that.
Absolutely.
Well, that brings an end to that segment. And with it, Nick, I believe, what do we have coming to people? We don't even know. We don't even know what we have coming to people's way the rest of this month. It's Wing It Month. We're going to have some stuff. We're not going to have some stuff. You never know what we're going to throw at you. We may throw nothing at you. You never know. But we will be here, same bat time, same bat channel next week, death aside. We will bring you another episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And, Nick, why don't you just sign us off from here?
Well, I would, except for we got one more little piece of business to attend to. You know, when last Jim Ross joined us to sing, you know, to do his rendition of of a popular song. We were talking about Reba McEntire and her triumphant return to the CMAs. She looked outstanding, you know, did a great job. However, there was another individual who appeared on the old CMA Awards that some of you may know, may not know, by the name of Gretchen Wilson, who didn't look so great. And so we thought, you know, we gave Reba the rub. Why not give old Gretchen the rub as well? So Jim, I don't know if you know this song, but why don't you take it away?
Man, I feel like a woman. Oh, sorry, it's a different song. Different song. Follow me here, folks. It's real simple. Well, I ain't never signed the Barbie doll types, Kelly Kelly's, people like that. No, I don't swig on that sweet champagne, a little bit of the bubbly. I understand. That's a big in right now. I don't understand it. I don't get it. What is the end? I'd rather drink beer all night like Stone Cold Steve Austin in a tavern or watching a honky-tonk man match. I want a four-wheel drive tailgate. I have got posters on my wall, Todd, Austin, and Williams. Some people look down on me, but I don't give a rip. I stand barefooted in my own front yard. My feet covers the grounds they walks on with a baby on my hip. And you know why? Because I am a redneck woman. I ain't no high-class broad. Pardon my language, understand. Go ahead and tweet me. Inappropriate. Go ahead. What kind of world we're living in now, but people are just gonna get offended. I'm just a product of my raising, folks. I say, hey, y'all, and yee-haw, and I keep my Christmas light on my front porch all year long. And I know the word to every Charlie Daniels song. But here's to all my sisters out there. Keeping it country. Just give me a big hell yeah, like the bionic roundneck. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. You want to know what Victoria's Secret was? Well, she was a real nice worker. She was real underrated, in my opinion, by the way, Conrad. You couldn't buy a worker like that on a Walmart shelf half price. Victoria was tough. $2 steak tough. And still looks sexy as hell. Just as sexy as those models on TV. Now, I don't need no designer tag to make my man want me. Now, I understand. I can hear right now on your Twitter, your Brian Alvarez, your Dave Meltzer. Oh, you might think I'm trashy. A little too hardcore. They didn't like that Moxley and Omega match. Too hardcore. But in my neck of the woods, I'm just the girl next door, my friend. Hey, I am a redneck woman. I ain't no high-class broad. I am just a product of my raising. And I say, hey, y'all, and yee-haw. And I keep my Christmas lights on the front porch all year long. And I know the words to every Tanya Tucker song, including that one for little busted leg Jimmy Dickens. So here's to all my sisters out there keeping it country. Let me get a big hell yeah from the redneck girls like me. Hell yeah, hell yeah. Redneck woman. I ain't no damn high-class broad. I am a product of my raising. And I say, hey, y'all, and yee-haw. I keep my lights on the front porch all year long. Blah, blah, blah. And I know the words to every single Stone Cold entrance song, including that one from Disturbed, where you can't understand the damn word that they're saying. You know, one that's like, ooh, ah, ah, ah. And it's like, Stone Cold's coming, and they're living inside you. Let's give me a big hell yeah from the redneck girls like me. Hell yeah, hell yeah, hell yeah, hell yeah, hell yeah. Tony, Conrad, Excalibur, hell yeah. For AEW, for TNT, this is good old JR saying hell yeah.
Our traveling fanboys.